As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is a podcast from The Times. Go to thetimes.co.uk.
Hi, I'm Gabriel Marcotti, and you have wisely downloaded The Game, the football podcast that has to try and make sense of another week in the Wild West of the Premier League. As much as I'd love to hit this writing solo, guns a-blazing, and just deliver 60-minute monologue, which is my forte, I need some deputies to help me out. So I've rounded up both Smiths, Ben and Rory, as well as, from the Great Peak District, it's Peter Lansley. So let's remove the ladies from the saloon, and let's roll. Okay, we're going to start at Old Trafford. There's obviously plenty to talk about on this show, but I want to start with a very minor self-contained point. I don't know if there's any legal minds here. I don't like lawyers myself, but I was just struck by something. The Red Issue fanzine before the game, I haven't actually seen it. Has anybody seen it?
Yeah. I've seen the cover, yeah.
Okay, can you describe, will you stop fiddling the papers? You have one with you, do you, Ben? A contraband copy.
It's in there.
It said there's a copy of it in the game today. Can you describe it, Rory?
It's a black background with a white hooded front, which says LFC Suarez is innocent, I believe.
Okay, so the police decided to confiscate it because it incited racial hatred. Everybody in agreement that this was a good idea, and we need the police to go and confiscate satirical publications?
I was going to say, I don't quite get how it incites racial hatred. I could vaguely understand if they thought it was generally incendiary and unnecessary. It would still be harsh.
Yeah, I think it featured a cut out and keep KKK mask on the front. So I think the idea was that fans would cut this out, put it on their heads and wear it during the game. So I think if that had been the case, that might have caused problems.
Lansley?
Yeah, it's outrageous. I think it becomes a civil matter and the police have got to get involved, yeah.
So you think the police were justified?
Yes, I do, yeah.
Okay, all right.
I think it's like, it speaks for itself. I think it's terrible if we're entering those waters.
All right, well, I guess we'll postpone this discussion to the free speech podcast one day and debate the aspects of it.
Yeah, I mean, we can't be seen to be, you know, stifling free speech, but I think if there comes a point where, you know, you have fans wearing masks in a game that is already explosive, that might add to the situation as the handshake
It's a very interesting debate. For my part, I'm a free speech, pretty close to free speech absolutist. I think satire should be well beyond the remit of censorship, but unfortunately, so much other stuff happened this weekend, so let's move on quickly. Okay, now, I'm just going to try to piece together what we know, and if I say something that's incorrect, please jump in and correct me. Luis Suarez had told Kenny Dalglish that he would shake Patrice Evra's hand. He goes out there. I'm assuming we all agree that it was Suarez who did not shake his hand despite the conflicting videos which appeared on. I mean, that certainly looked like that to me. So, first and foremost, this is a case of Luis Suarez agreeing to do something with his manager and then at the final minute deciding not to follow his manager's instructions. Now, I think this is really, really, really bad and disrespectful towards Liverpool and towards Kenny Dalglish. Am I wrong?
Yeah, I think that's fair. He obviously had agreed to do it, and then we don't know whether it was a spur of the moment thing or whether he deliberately misled Kenny Dalglish. I suppose the easiest thing to think is that it was spur of the moment. He sort of saw Evra and decided that he didn't really fancy it. And no, it is. It's true. There's no question that it was a moronic thing to do from Suarez. I think it's dangerous to start eliding the handshake with the original offence, to start pretending they're as serious as each other. I don't think they are.
Serious in different ways.
Well, one's a discourtesy. One's sort of an accusation of racial abuse.
No, I'm not so much interested in the discourtesy towards Evra, which obviously it was, and that's one factor. But when you have a manager on a very sensitive matter like this, with the world going out of his way to tell you, shake his hand before the game, let's draw a line under it. I know some people criticized Dalglish on Monday for saying, you know, reiterating that he should have never been banned. But as of Friday, I saw an interview with Dalglish where he said, you know, he's done, you know, let's draw a line under it, let's move on. So there was obviously this intent, Ben, from the club to make sure that Suarez at least went through the motions of shaking the hand and they could move on. And he deliberately went against what the club, his employers, told them to do.
Yeah, I think that's a serious aspect to this. I agree with Rory in terms of shaking someone's hand in terms of the Premier League and the kind of ticking a box that is now is not a serious matter. But betraying your manager in the way he did and the club is a serious matter. It's made a fool of Dalglish after the game, and it made an already explosive situation into something far worse. And the story went yesterday that he somehow thought Evra was going to snub him and therefore got his retaliation in first, which is an incredibly stupid thing to do because he comes out looking like an idiot and he's making himself something of a pariah in the English game, which is a real shame for someone who's got so much talent.
It's a strange thing with Suarez, having met him and interviewed him. This is an easy sort of trite observation to make, but he's a lovely bloke when you speak to him away from the pitch. My personal interpretation, and this is not based in any evidence whatsoever, is that it was again an attempt to sort of win some sort of psychological battle with Evra to gain an advantage. I think that's what Suarez's past career sort of suggests he was probably trying to do.
Right. Like the psychological battle he won when he bit Otman Bakal.
Yeah, I mean, that's, I think biting someone wins a battle, right. Gab, we all know that.
Clearly.
But as you say, it is dangerous. What he's done is undermined Dalglish, and he's kind of lost any goodwill that people, even Liverpool fans, maybe should have had for him. And it's very strange to try and sort of tally up that character with the character who you actually meet when you meet Luis Suarez, who is nothing like that. It's a real sort of Jekyll and Hyde thing. It's quite interesting psychologically.
Lansley, are you buying this Jekyll and Hyde thing? I mean, is there a real Suarez, or are these two sides of the same Suarez? Have you come across footballers like this before?
Yeah. Oh, it's just, it's very two-faced, isn't it? And you get that, don't you? You do get two-faced people, unfortunately, and if they have two faces, one of which is very nice.
Sorry, Lansley, two-faced, to me at least, has very negative connotations.
Yeah,
Jekyll and Hyde, which is the term Rory used, is slightly kinder, but you're going with the two-faced.
Yeah, I think Jekyll and Hyde is ultimately not a very nice individual, because it suggests there's two sides to your personality, and you can only go by the weakest link, can't you? If you're capable of being that horrible, then the nice face that you can put on in an interview is only superficial. You have to be judged by the weakest link, don't you?
Ben, what will Dalglish do, in your opinion, and what should he do, in your opinion?
There's a lot of suggestion this morning that they plan to sell Suarez in the summer, and as we understand it, that isn't the case. I think there is a feeling that Suarez can make up for this and try and patch things up.
He has apologised, unreservedly, I think.
Yeah, and I think Dalglish will talk to him this week again. I think there will be a series of meetings between the club and Suarez, Dalglish and Suarez. They've got to get that trust back between player and manager. I mean, I think that's going to have hurt the relationship, but I don't think it's beyond repair, and I don't think Dalglish has any intention of binning this player.
Well, maybe it's more trust between manager and player, given that Dalglish has gone to the wall for this guy.
Yeah, sure.
I think everyone at Liverpool has to look at the way they've behaved over this. Suarez is the ultimate culprit. He's the one who's caused it. Dalglish has been far too belligerent and aggressive in the way he's tried to handle it. It's Dalglish who's driven the defence, the way the club have handled the entire affair, and that's what's dragged the club through the mud as much as Suarez's original offence. It's Liverpool's inability to accept any culpability. I think the frustration for a lot of people, if you look at Sir Alex Ferguson's the way he dealt with the Evra celebration, which I know we're going to come on to, Ferguson said, yeah, he shouldn't have done that. Liverpool should have taken a much more conciliatory approach while still defending Suarez. What the handshake revealed is that Suarez clearly doesn't think he's done anything wrong. He has that right. He doesn't have to think he's done anything wrong. The FA have clearly failed to educate him and what have you. But Liverpool's response has been so, yeah, one-sided, so black and white, that it's sort of not brought any room for debate, and that's been really dangerous. I think everyone at Liverpool has to look at the way they've handled the
affair. I think from the very start of this process, there's been the attitude has been wrong. I mean, they felt hard done by, which if they genuinely feel that Suarez is innocent, you can understand that. But unfortunately, that has been perceived as a kind of an arrogant and as Rory says, a belligerent approach that's gone from top to bottom, from Dalglish all the way through to the owners, who have said very little or nothing until this point. And I think that has reflected badly on Liverpool.
I felt bad for Dalglish in the post game with Jeff Shreves. Obviously, as a journalist, I don't think he behaved appropriately. But by the same token, it struck me as a guy who, you know, been back in management a year after 11 years away out of the game. I don't think he could have conceived the fact that he would one day have to be dealing with this kind of crap, you know, not as a player, not as when he managed Liverpool in the late 80s. And I mean, to me he just looked shaken, and I had a bit of sympathy for him. One man who did not look shaken, who looked in control as ever, was Sir Alex after the game. Lansley, I mean, Rory pointed out that, you know, he put the boot into to Suarez, which, fair enough, he's doing his job as manager. He's also rightly, some might say cleverly, criticized Evra for his excessive celebration at the end.
I think Evra should and will get dealt with by the FA for his excessive celebration. Maybe he'll get a match ban, whatever. I don't know, what did Gary Neville get? Can you remember when he celebrated excessively down the touchline?
A £4,000 fine, I think.
But he's not Gary Neville.
Okay, so I think that is, you know, that's a sanction that is warranted. But Suarez's crime, if you like, his snub, has to be taken in the context of the original offence and the 8-match ban, and it goes far, far deeper. And it also sparked everything that went on afterwards.
On the game, I thought it was actually closer than most people think. Most people, most accounts I've read, is that United wiped the floor with Liverpool in the end, though. I thought it was, you know, Liverpool didn't play particularly well, but it was 2-1, and De Gea made a great save in the end. I want to get you guys on De Gea's second straight week that De Gea, you know, saves the bacon. Those are three extra points that United have in the table that they wouldn't have otherwise. They'd be, what, 5 back from City. Is this De Gea coming on, or is it De Gea still with... Is it the same De Gea as before, basically? We knew he could make those great saves, but we knew also that, you know, he had potentially some other weaknesses, Ben.
I think it is exactly that. I think he's made a couple of fantastic saves that will breed confidence in him, which is what he's been desperately short of. And I think as he settles into England, as he feels more part of the team, if he can make saves and contribute in that way, I think he'll only improve. I think he's still susceptible to those small mistakes, but if he can keep making those big match-winning saves or winning points here and there, it's going to help him. He's going to settle.
I agree with Ben. I think when he came from Spain, the issue in Spain with him was that he was dodgy on long-range shots. His foot positioning on long-range shots isn't right, so he doesn't get the right spring, which means he will get beaten by long-rangers, as he was by Dzeko in his first game in English football and has been since. The fact that he's improved that to stop Glenn Johnson's shot and the one at Chelsea suggests that he's working on that. The issue I'd have with De Gea is I think that the way that Liverpool played him in the FA Cup game, just making men stand next to him, means that he will throughout his career concede goals from set pieces. I think what has happened in the first 6 months will influence the rest of his career in England.
So over at Goodison, Everton and Chelsea, another defeat for Chelsea. We'll be talking some Villas-Boas in a minute. But Peter, I wanted to get you on Everton because I'm sort of fascinated. I know you're a big fan of Star Trek Voyager and how they have the Doctor and he can only exist on the hologram as a hologram when he's in the medical bay. And when he goes somewhere else, he kind of disappears. I need to explain to me, how is it that Pienaar can be at Spurs under Harry and never get a game, and, you know, Harry right now, most people would agree, possibly the best English manager. By the same token, Louis Saha can be at Everton under Davy Moyes, who most of us agree, you know, he's not the best Scottish manager for obvious reasons, but he's a very good manager. And then these guys just kind of sort of swap places, and all of a sudden they're both very, very good. What is it?
It's a strange one, isn't it? I mean, Pienaar was obviously really comfortable at Everton. He's really, you know, he found his niche there. Absolute class player in the system that Moyes plays. I think when he went to Tottenham, there were very similar style players who were just that bit better than him, Luka Modric, etc. As for the Sahar one, I think he's the sort of player who seems to need a fresh challenge pretty regularly. He's also, I don't know the guy, I don't know if Rory bumped into him much at Everton, but he seems quite vulnerable in confidence. And if Harry Redknapp had said to him, look, you are going to get your chance, you're going to be coming on alongside Adebayor, you're going to be playing alongside him sometimes, then Harry knows how to inflate a character with fresh confidence. Maybe it's just that they needed a new scene, they needed a fresh start.
Yeah. Sometimes the simplest explanations perhaps are the correct ones, although certainly not the most satisfying. Everton, obviously, two big wins recently, and those of us who are Davy Moyes fans are happy. Let's move to Chelsea now. Right. I'm interested in this fact that, like, when Abramovich appears at the training ground, it's kind of like seen by, interpreted by us as like the vultures circling. Yeah. Now, I covered Chelsea a little bit. I don't know about you. I don't speak to Roman Abramovich. Sometimes in our line of work, I get to speak to people who are close to him or claim to be close to him. These people seem to interpret his thoughts as if he was some kind of Cassandra. But then he goes and does something totally different. Do we have any idea whether it's gone anything past the obvious, which is if Villas-Boas doesn't finish in the top four, his job is in jeopardy, but actually Abramovich's presence really makes no difference?
I think Abramovich's presence is probably over-interpreted, like you say. I don't think the fact that he's at the training ground is significant beyond the fact that his trial with Boris Berezovsky is now finished, which means he can start thinking about football again. I think that's important. He will speak to Villas-Boas, who's in charge of one of his most important investments, or certainly most publicly important investments, regularly, whether he's at the training ground or not. So I don't think that's particularly significant. What I think is significant is Chelsea's form, which is 2 wins from the last 10, which is bad enough. This isn't a case of Abramovich being sort of trigger happy and a bit sort of megalomaniacal to trying to sort of win things constantly. Chelsea are in a rut of form, a really bad rut. I think if Napoli put Chelsea out of the Champions League, I think Villas-Boas goes.
Well, it's interesting, Ben, because the image of Abramovich as being sort of this trigger happy lunatic and whatever. I actually look back, and you know, Mourinho, I think it's clear to anybody who followed the club, effectively sacked himself at the time. Grant and Hiddink were clearly interim appointments; they weren't going to stay. Scolari was objectively awful. I might suggest that actually, while Scolari looked disinterested, and Villas-Boas to me does not look disinterested, quite the contrary, I'd actually argue in some ways maybe this Chelsea side is worse than Scolari's side, or plays worse football. But all that said, it seems to me that the only sort of rash trigger sacking that he really made was Ancelotti last year. Am I wrong on that? I mean, does the guy really have a problem? Or do we just love to spin this idea of like, oh, look, it's crazy, wealthy Russian oligarch sacking everybody in sight. Ha ha, let's laugh at him because we're jealous of his money and his girlfriend.
No, I know what you're saying. I think when you say it in those terms, I think it is hard to argue bar Ancelotti, which does look like a bad mistake. Villas-Boas is clearly struggling in England. I mean, he came in with this big reputation, this mini Mourinho reputation, but I think all along he's struggled with the fact that he has to try and rebuild a team with players he probably doesn't want and players who don't necessarily have the respect for him he deserves. He's fighting a losing battle, and you know, afterwards talking to him on Saturday, he looks like, you know, a man who's been ground down, and I think, as Rory says, a defeat in the Champions League, which we know that how much that means to Roman Abramovich, I think that would be very, very hard to recover from.
But there were tremendous individual mistakes from players who are supposed to be good, like Ashley Cole and stuff at the weekend.
Yeah.
Is that something you can put down to the manager?
No, I don't think it is, but I think
But there are other things you can legitimately put down to the manager, right?
I don't think it's a happy camp. I don't think it's been a happy
camp.
What
has he done wrong?
I don't think he's done anything wrong. I think
Think he's made any bad decisions this year?
I think he came in at the beginning.
I can give you a big list.
I think he came in at the beginning and he had a decision to make with the senior players. Did he go into the season with the guys who are basically Mourinho's boys, or did he try and rebuild a team in a few months? He decided to keep faith with these guys, and I think in October, November, he realised that was a mistake. And he's now got a bunch of players who don't particularly like him, and a bunch of, and he doesn't particularly like them. I think he needs a summer really to turn this around, and I'm not sure he's going to get it.
I think, as I say, if Napoli put them out, I think that's that. I think there's no guarantee they'll get fourth. If you look at the fixtures, I would suggest that probably Liverpool and Arsenal have actually got more favourable fixtures than Chelsea, although Chelsea probably have the experience that you'd want. Yeah, I think Ben's right. I think he came in, he made the choice to stick with the old guard. It's not worked. The old guard know that he's in this weird quandary where they have to play well so that he can get rid of them. That's not a recipe for success.
Obviously, Chelsea don't have a director of football that we know of. We just have this cloud of people who appear to influence the owner. Now, obviously, the owner's not going to sack himself, but there must be somebody who convinced the owner that it would be a good idea to go and spend 50 million euros in compensation to Porto to get Villas-Boas and to sort of wait until the end of June, early July to go and do it, leaving him less time to prepare. There's got to be somebody who advised them on this, same way there was somebody who advised them on Torres. Well, we know who it was on Torres, and unfortunately he's going to get away with it because he's a mate. But who is it? I mean, do you have any idea who told them? I mean, if you were Abramovich, if I was Abramovich, I would go and I would say, I mean, I don't know. Is it Ron Gurley? Who are these people? I would go and I would sack these people for putting him in this position. Because if, as you said, he's so busy with the Berezovsky trial, he's doing other things, and somebody comes to him, oh, yeah, get this guy, and then, you know, do this and that and that, and don't give him power to do that and whatever. I mean, somebody's got it. The buck has to stop with somebody here, right?
Well, the power structure of Chelsea is Ron Gurley, the chief executive, Bruce Butt, the chairman, and Michael Amanalo, who I think probably occupies the post. I can't remember what his exact title is. It might be technical director. Yeah. Who occupies the post of...
Right. So Michael Amanalo hasn't spoken to the media since the beginning of time, yeah? Yeah. Right, so is that... I mean, I don't know. It just strikes me that somebody's got to give answers. You can't just dump everything on Villas-Boas, which is what's going to happen if he does get sacked. But surely it's a shared decision. It seems to me like everybody's either blaming Villas-Boas or Abramovich. There are people in between whose job it is to understand football and to...
The train is now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Put Villas-Boas in a position where he can do his job, and to advise and to advise the owner on what to do.
It was a very strange one in the summer, because all along it was Hiddink's job. He was coming. It was, can they get him out of Turkey? Can they make it work? And then all of a sudden it changed, and somewhere along the line someone said, "Let's go and get AVB." The talk, Chelsea were always briefing that wasn't the case. Villas-Boas himself said he wanted another season in Portugal. And then all of a sudden it changed. I don't know who made that decision. It may have been Abramovich himself. We just just don't know. He may have fancied this mini Mourinho and thought he's the man to fix it.
Stop calling him. No,
I know he doesn't like it, but it's an obvious link for Abramovich to make. He reads the papers. He's gonna make that connection.
We're assuming Abramovich is stupid, and that every like young Portuguese manager is the mini Mourinho.
Is it possible? That's what he thought.
Yeah, it's possible. Right. It's possible he thought of it as a mini Ferguson, too.
But it is possible that he made the decision himself. I agree he isn't advised well, and I think people are scared of him, and maybe that's understandable. Yeah. But he doesn't have someone who can tell him the truth. I don't believe he has someone who tells him the truth at Chelsea.
From a manager who may be relieved of duty to one who was relieved of duty, it just happened a few minutes ago. Not based on when you're listening to it. Based on when we're recording it. But Mick McCarthy is no longer manager of Wolves. They were beaten 5-1 at home to West Brom. Peter, you're out there. Is it a knee jerk thing or was it coming? I mean, what I mean is, had they drawn 1-1, would he still be in a job?
Do you know what? I think he would be. I obviously, results have been terrible. You know, 14 points from 22 games or whatever. It's relegation form. The Wolves are the sort of club who have prided themselves on, you know, a long-term sustainability. Listening to all that Chelsea chat, you know, you're thinking, how are they ever going to build anything for the future? Which is what Wolves, with their more modest expectations, have been trying to do. I think the defeat by West Bromwich Albion just means that it was a humiliation too far. Only a couple of weeks ago, the word from the boardroom was that Wolves were going to see it through to the end of the season with Mick McCarthy, whether they went down or not, and that then he might well, if they did go down, would be the man who could bring them back up again. But I think the nature of the defeat by Liverpool, 3-0 at home, which is abject, when Steve Morgan then came into the changing room after the game and lambasted the players, not the manager, but the players for their efforts, then led to a bit of tension between chairman and manager. McCarthy will have said, will you leave this to me, please? Steve Morgan's gone away on a holiday and said, right, I'm leaving it to you. It's down to you now. And it was just too humiliating to lose 5-1 at home to your local rivals, and in such a manner. I mean, in 5-1, it could have been 6-7-8. Wow. That meant that result has nailed the coffin, yeah.
Sometimes you have to make painful decisions. If you were Steve Morgan, you'd be a lot wealthier than you are now, and you wouldn't be talking to me. But would you have made that decision?
For the good of the club, I think Mick McCarthy is a really good manager for Wolves. But I think it got into a rut, and there's little nuances in the dressing room that have not helped. Because he's such a man for unity and solidarity and leadership and all the rest of it, all these great British characteristics. I don't know. I think pivotal to Wolves just going off the rails slightly and McCarthy losing his job is the replacing of Carl Henry with Roger Johnson as captain. Carl Henry embodies what Mick McCarthy's teams are about. He's non-glamorous. He does his job flipping well. And he kept Wolves steady. When Mick McCarthy hung his hat on Roger Johnson and said, you are my captain, come in and lead this team because that's going to upgrade us, that just changed the dynamics of the dressing room a little bit. I don't think the other players believe in Roger Johnson the same as they do with Carl Henry. And then while Carl Henry has been out suspended for 3 games, Wolves have gone off the rails. And I think that buying a player, it turned out to be the wrong player, that just unhinged Wolves and eventually cost McCarthy's job.
What's the next step? Where do you look? Because I've always championed, and people laughing if you're saying this, hey, let's look at managers who are good and up and coming in the lower divisions. But is it something that's realistic for a club like Wolves? Or are we going to be spun this line? They want the big name. They want, you know, Kerbishley or Megson or whatever. Maybe not Megson, but you know what I mean?
I think.
In
terms of whether this is a good decision to sack McCarthy or not, depends on who you get to replace him. So why sack Mick McCarthy and replace him with Neil Warnock or Alan Kerbishley or Gary Megson? They play the same sort of football with the same sort of success.
So why not replace him with Eddie Howe?
Well, exactly.
Eddie Howe, by the way, is, I don't follow the lower divisions. I trust Eddie Howe is still promising manager doing well in the lower divisions.
Burnley are doing okay. There's Eddie Howe, there's Lee Clark. He'd be a fantastic appointment. Carl Robinson at MK Dons, they'd be, again, these are up-and-coming young managers. But what will happen, I'm fairly certain, and Pete will know more about this than I do, is that they will go for someone who has a proven track record of failure, because that's what they will always do.
So it's Megson then?
Megson or Steve Bruce.
Well, that's exactly it. I mean, why sack a guy who knows the players? Fair enough, they haven't played for him this weekend. You've got 3 months of a season left. life. Someone's got to come in and try and get them out of trouble. And the odds say that they're going to go down now. Whoever they bring in, they might get a few games out of them, but can they really be expected to save Wolves with the players that Mick's been using? I don't see it. I just don't see it.
Why? So they're better managers than Mick. Yeah, of course there are.
But would you have made the change, Gab? Would you make the change and feel that you can get them out of trouble?
I'm all for giving other people a chance. I would like some imagination in the appointment and looking at, you know, the history of English football, which until about 10, 15 years ago has been about, you know, using the lower divisions as a proving ground for talent, and give somebody a crack. Don't sign him up to a long contract, but, you know, bring somebody in, see if he can manage, see how he can do. Sometimes that's what it takes. But if you want to go back to the Steve Bruce, Megson, Kerbishley, nothing wrong with those people, but
yeah. They are not, let's face it, those managers are, as they are in their stage of their careers now, they're no better than what Mick McCarthy is. All they are is a fresh voice. So Neil Warnock, as he came in, I mean, Neil Warnock's great for a quote, he's full of life and energy and everything, but is he a better tactician than Mick McCarthy? No, I don't think he is. So all Wolves can hope to get, if they make that sort of change, is the fresh voice impetus. Now, Wolves have got a decent squad. If you're talking lower half of the Premiership, Wolves have got some quality in Doyle and Jarvis and Fletcher and people like that. They are decent players. So a fresh voice might get them the two or three wins and give them the confidence that means they stay up. But if you go into a new season with someone like Neil Warnock or Gary Megson in charge, is the long term really any rosier? I don't think that it is.
Exactly. I think, but Gab, sorry,
but if you now go in and give, I mean, blimey, look at Lambert and Rodgers now. But if you go and give a young, an ed- or Nigel Adkins, you know, a lower division manager who's done very well, the job at Wolves now, there's no guarantee that they will have the presence to keep them up.
I've never bought this presence argument. Your boss is your boss. You know, you still got to earn respect at every level, and you earn it through your methods. I thought Sean O'Driscoll, for example, was very good before the evil empire took over that club. There are intelligent, progressive English managers out there who are not given a chance because of the old boy network, and the only way you can break in is if you get promoted to the Premier League. I hope people take the opportunity to learn a little bit about Rodgers and Megson and their experience. And of course, and Rodgers, by the way, also had an awful spell at one of his earlier clubs, too, and then showed that he's actually a pretty good manager, and everybody wants him. Let's move on from a manager who has been sacked and a manager who may be sacked at some point to a manager who I think it's safe to say will not be sacked in the very near future, and that's Harry Redknapp. Since we were last on, Fabio Capello is no longer the England manager. Officially, he's resigned. I personally don't think he has. I think he was pushed. I think the FA handled it terribly, but we're not here to go and rehash all that. There is a possibility England might be better off, but I want to get you guys on Redknapp, because there's one thing, one pet peeve of mine. Whenever people talk up Redknapp in this country, whether it's for the England job or for Spurs, they always make the same points about, look, you know, his enthusiasm, and he gives people self-belief and all this stuff. And that's all great. It kind of ties in slightly with what Roy was saying earlier. A few years ago, we did a podcast on this. Gian Balagay and I spent sort of 3-4 hours in Redknapp's kitchen in that house in Sandbanks, when he just talked about football and Greenwood and the academy, and he took out bits of paper and drew little diagrams. And I got the sense that this is somebody who actually has a lot of tactical nous, which is very rarely talked about. And I look at his teams, and sometimes Spurs play very attractive, well-organized football, attacking football. Sometimes they defend very well. It seems to me like this guy's got, you know, he may have other weaknesses, but there's actually a football brain there. Why do we so rarely talk about it? Is it just because the whole Cockney side of things is so overbearing, Ben?
I think it is. I think people judge a book by its cover, and you think here's a crafty Cockney who can get the boys up for a good old game out in the park, and you think, you know, probably not a lot there. He can give them a good old team talk and send them out with a bit of oomph, and hopefully that'll be enough. But the reality is, a good manager who's done well at the top level has got to have a bit more about him than that. I think Harry is clever. I think against Liverpool, you saw, you know, they came very solid, defended extremely well, knew what he wanted to come and take a point, and that's what they went away with. It was a good example of how flexible he can be.
Peter, are we so shallow that we just look at the outsized character and that, you know, if Harry Redknapp spoke in complete sentences the way Martin O'Neill does, we might think that he's actually very clever? I mean, I don't think anybody... you hear the word intelligent, for example. People say O'Neill's intelligent, and he undoubtedly is. But with Redknapp, I don't think I've ever heard the word intelligent, you know, put next to him. It's more like crafty, clever, and whatever. Is it our fault that we can't judge his body of work without somehow judging the individual?
Yeah, it is, isn't it? Because intelligence in terms of whether you've been to Belfast University or whether you've got the street wisdom of Harry Redknapp are two different things. There's football intelligence, and if you're going to be a good manager, you've got to have that. It's just, I think Redknapp has got this man-management thing about him that knows how to say the right thing at the right time, as O'Neill has. And by the way, Gav, you mentioned O'Neill before I did this show.
Yeah, I did, yes.
But I think he's got that ability to say the right thing at the right time. And like you said about the flexibility. I mean, Redknapp is just fantastic at knowing and having the bravery of when to switch. It's intuitive, though, isn't it?
Okay, so this is an audio podcast, but I can tell you that Rory K. Smith is pulling faces. We're all for debate here. Are you going to humbly and respectfully dissent from our celebration of Harry?
No, I was trying to work out if that was Pete's windscreen wipers or his indicator.
I thought it was a windscreen wiper, yeah.
It's windscreen wipers. I'm in Wolverhampton, therefore it is raining.
There you go.
I think with Harry, he plays up to the image. I think the people around him play up to the image. And I genuinely don't know, having spoken to people on Spurs' coaching staff, how much tactical work do they do? I don't think they do a lot.
I don't think they do a lot. I mean, Van der Vaart gave that great quote saying we have a clipboard in the dressing room, Harry never uses it. And you know, they're thrilled with that. But
was he able to trick me in Balaguer? Were we just gullible and stupid?
Maybe you're not as tactically astute as you think you are.
Maybe we're just enthralled by the ridiculous house the man lives in.
It was the crafty Cockney charm that got you. I think you were blinded by it.
The greatest trick the devil ever pull gap was convincing the world he didn't exist.
Clearly. Anyway, on the Red App issue, it's going to obviously resolve itself one way or another. I'll leave you with this thought. I think right now, if you're Daniel Levy, you are the happiest man in the world, maybe even happier than Harry, because you're either going to keep a manager who's doing very, very well, or you're going to get an absurd amount of money for it. And as for David Bernstein, I don't know who he answers to, or if it's little buddy Alex Horn. But I see dark storm clouds ahead for the FA, because I think somebody's going to make them pay. Time now for your favorite part of the program. It's Quick Hits. Louis Saha scores twice as Tottenham annihilate Newcastle 5-1. Rory, I know he's had injuries, but hindsight being 2020, it's not really the cleverest move by Everton to let him go, was it?
For a man who spends most of his life complaining he never has any strikers, David Moyes has made two fairly spectacular errors of judgment this year, Yakubu being one, who he basically ostracised from Everton. Saha looking like the other. What I would say is that Saha always scores goals in bursts. He's had a great start. It won't last.
Oh, there you go. No faith in Saha. But hey, enjoy Velios and Strakwalursi. You would think that if you lose 1-0 against the league leaders and have two great chances to win at the end, yeah, you might get some love from your fans, at least a little bit of love. But Alex McLeish was crucified again by the Villa faithful at the weekend. Lansley, is the criticism fair? And please tell me they're not just having a go because McLeish is a bit of a blue nose.
I don't think the criticism is fair. I think Villa fans should wise up to the fact that they've lost four England players, okay, for big money over the last couple of years, and that this is now a period of transition in which they see whether Gary Gardner and Kieran Clarke and co are good enough for the Premier League and to take the club forward. And sadly, I think a lot of it is to do with McLeish being perceived as a blue nose. But he's not just a blue nose, is he? He's a graduate of the Sir Alex Ferguson School, and he's a Scot made out of granite, and he's much more that than he is a blue nose.
Manchester City kept their lead intact in that Villa game. Roberto Mancini even suggested that Carlos Tevez could be welcomed back into the fold. Ben, since we clearly haven't talked about the subject enough, let's talk about it again. Is this a good idea, and is it going to happen?
It looks like it's going to happen. He's due to arrive in Manchester on Tuesday, back at training on Tuesday. Is it a good idea? It has a potential recipe for disaster if Tevez is a disruptive influence. But if it's on Mancini's terms, if Tevez comes back on Mancini's terms, then he still has a lot to contribute. And it may just push his transfer fee up in the summer as well.
By the way, Manchester City's John Guidetti, who's eligible for about 17 different countries, has scored something like 88 goals in the last 9 games, something stupid like that. Might want to consider that too for the future if you're a City fan. Thierry Henry scored a dramatic winner for Arsenal in a 2-1 victory over Sunderland. He'll play against Milan in the Champions League and then head back to Major League Soccer. Rory, if you're so inclined, please pay tribute to the great man in 30 seconds or less.
Well, yeah, Major League Soccer is rapidly becoming sort of a nursery for Premier League talent, isn't it? Robbie Keane's doing okay at Villa. Henry is impressed at Arsenal.
This is not a tribute to Henry. You're talking about MLS. We'd like a tribute to Henry.
Yeah, the words can't describe him. He's a superb human being and my hero in many ways. No, I think he's been great for Arsenal. I think it's given them a little bit of a lift psychologically. He's not the player he was, but he's had an impact. I would say that the two-month deal has worked. But I would add to that the caveat that Arsenal really need a long-term goal-scoring solution, and he is not it on the grounds that he's 34.
Clearly, given your words of love for Thierry Henry, you don't have a single drop of Irish blood in you. Peter Odemwingie nails a hat-trick as West Brom demolish Wolves in the Black Country Derby. Lansley, West Brom, 5 goals. Roy Hodgson, who'd have thunk, huh?
It's an amazing effort on the road from West Brom, isn't it? I think that's 13 points from the last 6 games, and it's up there with Arsenal and Tottenham, their away form. Home form, not quite so impressive, of course. They do like to counter-attack. They play with pace from the flanks. Odemwingie has found his mojo again. They know how to keep the ball beautifully. All credit to them. They were brilliant on Sunday.
It was one of those relegation 6-pointers between Wigan and Bolton, and Wigan won 2-1 away. Ben, even if Wigan go down, should somebody pick up Roberto Martinez? Or am I just sort of excessive and gushing in my love for him? Who would be good for Martinez?
I really like Martinez, and I think he's a smart manager. I think Wigan may end up going down, which would be sad, but I think he could do a great job somewhere else. Say Moyes went to Spurs, perhaps Everton. There we go.
There you go. Brush up on your scouse, Roberto.
Gab, one for you. Zambia are champions of Africa, winning a dramatic shootout with some perfect penalties against the Ivory Coast last night. Why are people so excited about this story?
Have you not read the papers in the past week or listened to the radio?
It's a rhetorical question.
Well, Rory, and I know you know because, like me, you're an enthusiast for foreign football. I mean, this is Hollywood stuff. Obviously, Zambia went into the tournament. Basically, their best player, Chris Katongo, plays in China. They've got 2 guys in Europe, one of them in the Russian second division, one of them a young boy, Mayuva. They went into this tournament with almost no expectations, and they played, I think, some of the best football in the tournament. But more importantly, of course, this was the 19th anniversary of the tragic plane crash, which killed all but 3 members of the Zambian national team back in 1993. And by the way, that was Zambian national team, which had done so well at the Olympics before that. And the plane crashed just off the coast of Gabon, where they actually won this tournament. From Ivory Coast perspective, I think you got to give them some credit, too, because they played a phenomenal tournament. For the first time in a while, they went with an African coach rather than sort of a high-priced Ericsson type rent-a-manager. And Francois Zahi, he did something that the previous guys weren't able to do. They were disciplined, they were organized, they tried to wear down the opponents, but in this game, I thought destiny was evidently on Zambia's side. Came to the most dramatic of penalty shootouts. If you get a chance, check it out on YouTube. I mean, the Zambians were singing during the shootout. Mwene, the Zambian goalkeeper, saves a penalty, does the cool John Cena sign, then goes and converts a penalty of his own. Interesting lesson here to be learned, English people who are all hung up on penalties. Bottle is crucial because the big star, when it came down for Ivory Coast to take the penalties, it was really interesting. Drogba had missed one in the 90 minutes. Drogba took the 5th penalty, but the other so-called big stars, Gervinho and Kolo Touré, they didn't go. They only went later because the matter wasn't settled in the first 5 penalty kicks, and you could even see Francois Zahi had to go and shout at Gervinho to get him to take the penalty. Absolutely amazing. High drama and a tremendous story. I know that was too long, but too much in the show. We should have done more on this.
That's all we've got time for this week. But remember, you can always follow us on www.thetimes.co.uk. You'll find your news, your gossip, your analysis, our web chats. I didn't do mine last week. Bad, Gab, bad. But I will be doing one this week on a Tuesday. Rory, do you do web chats?
I do. I was meant to do one today, but didn't. So I'll do one at some point in the near future.
Okay, let's not keep saying this because it makes us all look bad and unprofessional. I invite you to follow Ollie K's web chats because he's professional and his web chats are easily the best at the Times. You can also follow us on Twitter. I'm on there at Mark Cauchy. Ben, you're at Ben Smith Times.
I am.
And Rory?
At Rory Smith Times.
How imaginative. So hit us up there. Otherwise, catch us next week. Bye-bye.
Listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.